Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello and welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Bill Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas, and a former bank regulator and a central figure in prosecuting, there's a strange word, the corruption associated with the savings and loan crisis of the late 80s. He's been, since, a prominent voice against financial and political fraud, and in 2005 authored the excellent book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, How Corporate Executives and Politicians Looted the S&L Industry. So I'm sure he has a lot to say about our current situation. I'm really looking forward to Bill helping us understand why there were nearly 2,000 convictions resulting from the S&L crisis, but hardly any so far from the mortgage fraud and other criminal activity that caused the 2008 near system collapse, the one that made the scope of the S&L losses look positively quaint in comparison. Bill, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's jump right in. For many today, what they are experiencing is a crisis in confidence. Confidence in our entire system, that it's fair and fairly regulated and adjudicated. Perhaps even that if you make both your financial crime either large enough or complex enough or both, that you can get away with it. Perhaps maybe paying a fine that's a fraction of your illicit gain, but never facing criminal charges. At least that's the common experience today. So let's begin here. What is the basic definition of fraud? And more specifically, what is the form of fraud that we seem to be enmeshed in today?
Well, fraud is both a civil wrong and a crime. And what it is when I get you to trust me, and then I betray your trust in order to steal from you. And as a result, there's no more effective acid against trust than fraud, and in particular, elite fraud, which causes people to no longer trust folks. Economies break down, families break down, political systems break down, and such, if you don't have that kind of trust. So that's what fraud is. But what my work focuses on is, well, you know, what kind of frauds are the most devastating? And it turns out that the most kind of problems that we're seeing, as you said, systemic problems and such, arise when we have what we call in criminology control fraud. And control fraud simply means when you have a seemingly legitimate entity and the person who controls it uses it as a weapon to defraud others. And so in the financial sphere, the weapon of choice is accounting. And these losses from these kinds of control frauds exceed the financial losses from all other forms of property crime combined.
All other forms combined. Well, I can believe that. I mean, I saw what happened with WorldCom, with Enron. It took down Arthur Anderson, I guess, but most of the people that worked there ended up going to work other places. All of the there seems to be, it's not just the person at the top, the CEO, saying I'm going to really shuffle some deck chairs here and hide what the true state of my operation here is, what my risks are, what my liabilities are, whether I have the assets I claim I have. That requires a willing partner on some level, does it not?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you have this person at the top being a crook, they get to choose their partners.
Okay.
And they get to incentivize their partners. And as a result, you're quite right. They are very good at spreading frauds. And we call those echo epidemics. So, for example, in the current crisis, as with the prior ones, if you're a lender, there's an easy recipe for maximizing your accounting, fake accounting income, if you're a lender. And it goes like this. Four ingredients. One, grow like crazy. Two, by making really, really crappy loans. but at a premium yield. Yield just means interest rate. Three, while employing extreme leverage. And four, while setting aside only the most trivial reserves, allowances for the inevitable losses that this kind of behavior produces. So George Akerlof and Paul Romer wrote the classic article in Economics about this in 1993, and their title really says it all in terms of the dynamic. It's Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. So again, the idea is you have a seemingly legitimate entity. The person at the top is looting it. They loot it by destroying it, but they walk away wealthy. Of course, in the modern era, we may bail out the entity, so it may not even fail in that sense. But here's what Akerlof and Romer also said that was so critical as an understanding. They said these four steps, these four ingredients, it's just math. It is, and I'm quoting them now, a sure thing. So you're mathematically guaranteed, if you do these four things, to report not just substantial income, but record levels of income. And that's when Akerlof and Romer said, now that's the next thing that comes in that's really important, and that is modern executive and modern professional compensation. Because with modern compensation, first at the executive level, the CEO level, I can guarantee with modern executive compensation that if I follow this recipe, I will personally be wealthy almost immediately as the CEO. Because I'll base my compensation as CEO, and that's the nice thing about being CEO, you get to make the rules for yourself. You'll base it on short-term reported income, and you'll make that compensation extremely large for supposed superlative results. In jargon, in the industry, stretch goals. So you're going to say, hey, if I double my income in just a few years, which is what the Fannie Mae goal was, then I get an off-the-charts bonus, huge compensation. Except that, of course, that goal is easy to meet. You just have to cheat. It is a sure thing.
Now, Bill, is it possible to follow this four-step prescription and remain within the letter of the law?
No, not within the letter of the law, although it is in places that it may be. This is a question right now that's up for grabs. In places where international accounting rules apply. Because under international accounting rules, they're being interpreted by many folks as saying you are not permitted as a lending institution to establish any meaningful allowances for losses, loan losses now, even though it is absolutely certain that making, you know, remember the ingredient is the first two, grow extremely rapidly by making really, really awful loans at a premium yield. Well, that's guaranteed to produce massive losses down the road. The international accounting rules, many people are interpreting as you are not permitted to establish any reserves. So that could create the perfect crime in Europe in particular.
The perfect crime. Now, so even if you stay within these four, though, the parts that get me confused are what happens when, say, your supposed third-party auditing company comes in and performs their yearly due diligence audit and then signs off on the financial statements of this company and says, these have all been fairly represented and the risks have all been adequately explained and you know, we think this company is fairly representing itself, and then, you know, surprise, surprise, like Lucy pulling the football away. I mean, we always seem to be surprised when it turns out there are glaring, overt, gross, material misrepresentations of risk, of assets, of liabilities, of all kinds of things, and somehow that happens again and again and again. Where I'm really interested where the letter of the law is on this. Is there no responsibility here?
Well, the letter of the law in the United States under generally accepted accounting principles is that you have to establish the loss reserves now if you make large losses inevitable in the future. So, you know, and that if you actually establish the appropriate loss reserves, of course, you would show under this recipe that you're losing money, not making money, and you wouldn't get any bonus. So under the letter of the law, there's a fraud in the United States. It turns out there are many frauds in Europe as well because people get greedier. Now, let me approach your more basic question. And your more basic question really has two areas, and that is, so again, why are these control frauds unique? Why are they much more dangerous than regular frauds? And what is this thing that I alluded to, and that is professional compensation. So that'll bring in your question about the auditor.
Mm-hmm.
But if we back up, what's special when you have a seemingly legitimate entity and the person at the top of the food chain is the crook? You know, the joke that actually many cultures have, like China, that is, of course, that fish rot from the head.
Mm-hmm.
And that's designed to capture precisely this point. Well, so the big things about the seemingly legit enemy when the CEO is a crook. First, everybody reports to the CEO, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the CEO is the point failure mechanism where if he or she goes bad, almost everything may go bad as well. So all those things that we call in controls, internal and external controls, all report to the CEO, and the CEO therefore can, as I'll describe, use compensation, hiring, firing, praise, and such to produce the environment that will create allies for his fraud. Now note that what I'm saying, the CEO, the art of this is not to defeat your controls. The art, the elegant solution, as in mathematics, is to suborn the controls and turn them into your most valuable allies. And therefore, for example, when you are running an accounting control fraud, where your weapon of fraud is accounting, and that weapon of choice in finance is accounting, you're going to want to hire the most prestigious accountants as your outside auditors, because it is precisely their reputation that is most valuable when you can suborn them, and they give you that clean opinion that you just described that will help you deceive other shareholders. So one enormous advantage is internal and external controls come to the CEO level. A second incredible advantage is the CEO can optimize the firm as a weapon of fraud. And the CEO can do that. Basically, this falls into two big categories. One, you can put it in assets that have no readily verifiable market value. Because
mm-hmm.
then it's a lot easier to inflate asset valuations and to hide real losses.
Yeah.
And the second thing you do is grow like crazy. And of course, that is the essence of something your listeners have all heard about, and that is a Ponzi scheme. And so these accounting control frauds have strong Ponzi scheme-like elements, which is why they tend to cause such catastrophic losses.
Well, if a fish rots from the head, then you're talking about a culture issue, and I'm wondering if the head of the largest fish that we could talk about here is, what is substantially different about the type of control fraud you're talking about that's happening at the corporate level versus, say, I don't know, what happens when I examine the federal government's balance sheet and look at its accrual liabilities expanding by $4 to $5 trillion per year, once you factor in the actual entitlements and the government's reporting its cash balance deficits, which are shocking enough. But on an accrual basis, there's absolutely no possible chance that we can square this circle. Are companies following sort of a, are we talking about American culture now? Is this something that extends really broadly? I'm really confused.
This is human culture.
Human culture. Oh, okay.
And it is not limited to corporations. We've been focusing on corporations, but these frauds occur in the governmental sector, they occur in the nonprofit sector, and of course they occur in combination. And so crony capitalism is all about the combination of public sector and private sector control frauds working together as cronies.
So this is interesting because what you're saying is something I believe, which is that human nature does not change, and it's always human nature to try and game the system, get an advantage, have a free lunch, however we want to put that. And so we're sophisticated enough that we've seen these happen often enough that we know what the dynamic is. You've just mentioned this paper by these two gentlemen where you know there's four steps. We know what these all are. It is my view that we had tighter regulatory structures that were around the concept of saying, listen, these things are going to happen. We're going to put a basket around this as best we can and then do what we need to do in order to assure that these things do not flourish. Maybe we'll have prosecutions. So fast forward, I'm looking at a chart here. It shows federal prosecutions for financial fraud are at an all-time low. And my personal perception is that the amount of fraud is probably at an all-time high. They seem potentially correlated, that those two pieces of data. Is that true, and how did we get here?
Well, you have really interesting phraseology. You talked about we know, and you talked about we're more sophisticated. So this was part of, an important part, of what Akerlof and Romer were talking about in that paper. They chose to conclude the following paragraph, which I'll get approximately right from memory, and to make it their last paragraph for emphasis. They said, look, in the savings and loan crisis, economists and the public had no theory of this kind of fraud, control fraud. And as a result, they were not in a position to give strong support to the examiners in the field, the regulators, banking regulators, actually savings and loan regulators in the field, who recognized from the beginning that this kind of deregulation was bound to create widespread fraud. Now we know better. If we take advantage of this knowledge, we need not repeat this kind of crisis. That's written in 1993.
Right.
And what happened, of course, is right around the same time, we did get allegedly more sophisticated in a small part of we. And that small part of we dominated and continues to largely dominate policy. And that small portion of we had exactly the opposite conclusion on the basis of this alleged sophistication. And they said, and this is Easterbrook and Fischel. No, so your listeners need to know that George Akerlof goes on to win the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001. So we've been talking about one of the most prominent economists in the world. But in the law and economics world, a generation of American lawyers has been taught when they study the economics of corporations by a treatise written in 1991 by Judge Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit and Fischel, who was then a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, eventually the dean of the University of Chicago Law School. And Easterbrook and Fischel, and again I'll get this virtually word for word, say famously, a rule against fraud is not essential or even particularly important in the securities context. Now, notice how radical a statement that is. It isn't that we don't need laws, that we don't need prosecutors, that we don't need FBI agents, U.S. attorneys, those kind of folks. We don't even need a rule against fraud. We don't need the ability to bring civil suits. We don't need the Securities and Exchange Commission. Markets, securities markets, are so efficient that they automatically exclude any meaningful accounting control fraud. And we know that they're efficient because we hypothesize they're efficient. In the wonderful circularity, this was, of course, the efficient market hypothesis that was the centerpiece of all of modern finance theory. And even the weakest version of the efficient market hypothesis requires that there be no systematic errors in pricing. Because if there's any systematic error in pricing, well, then somebody would correct it. They would make money by correcting it. And therefore, financial bubbles are impossible as well. Fraud's impossible. Now, all of this is insane. And indeed, Fischel was the outside expert for three of the most notorious accounting control frauds of the savings and loan debacle era. Lincoln Savings, Michael Milken at Drexel Burnham Lamb Bear, and this incredibly sleazy Florida one as well, where the headquarters building was shown in Miami Vice for people who are old enough to know that. Yep. And then after he tried his theories in the real world and ended up praising the worst fraud in America, Charles Keating's Lincoln Savings, as the best savings and loan in America, he wrote those words that I've just quoted without ever telling the reader, hey, by the way, I tried this in the real world, and it was the most embarrassing disaster conceivable. So there's a strong element of intellectual dishonesty as well that went along with all of this. Anyway, if you believe that fraud's impossible in the financial sphere, if you believe that markets are inherently efficient and self-correcting, then there's a clear answer about what you should do about regulation, financial regulation. Financial regulation, A, is unnecessary, and B, is potentially very harmful because it will potentially stop or interfere, at least, with the self-correcting, efficient nature of the marketplace. And therefore, you must lead a jihad against regulation if you want the country to prosper. And that's precisely what these folks did. Well, okay, now that's academics. And yeah, they've trained a generation of lawyers who are now out there in key positions in business and regulation. But surely no one, you know, the adults, right, can't believe this. But in fact, they did, and in particular, Alan Greenspan had this view. So he famously, in his first meeting, first person-to-person meeting, with Brooksley Born, then the new chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, invites her over to meet her and says, in the course of the lunch, but of course we're going to disagree about things. Now, you know, they've never had a substantive discussion like this, and Brooksley's wondering, what? And he follows up and says, because you, for example, believe that fraud provides a basis for regulation, you know, preventing fraud. Now, that's how extreme, and that was, unfortunately, of course, the most powerful financial regulatory position in the world was held by someone who believed, you know, former Ayn Rand devotee, this insanity. But it gets worse, because Greenspan was also involved, hired by Charles Keating. In fact, Charles Keating hired Greenspan in multiple capacities, and one of those capacities was to, as lobbyist, to walk the floors of the Senate to recruit the five senators who would become known as the Keating Five when 25 years ago, on April 9th, 1987, they intervened on Keating's behalf, those five senators, secretly, to try to get us not to take enforcement action against Lincoln Savings. Keating also famously put in writing to our agency that Lincoln Savings should be allowed to do hundreds of millions of dollars of these direct investments, which is what we denied them the permission to do, and they did anyway. That was the violation of rules that the senators were trying to immunize by their political pressure. Mm-hmm. Well, Greenspan opined in writing that we should allow it because, and I'm quoting again, Lincoln Savings poses no foreseeable risk of loss. Gosh, he almost got that exactly right, except for the fact that it was the most expensive failure of the entire debacle at $3.4 billion, which, as you say, now sounds quaint.
Yeah.
But back in the day, used to be considered a substantial amount of money.
Well, it's, if I can turn a phrase around, it looks like no bad deed goes unrewarded in this story. And Greenspan is somebody that I've been, I wrote about him extensively going stretching way back because I really, really disagreed with his understanding of risk. He thought the derivatives markets made risk go away. So you, since you didn't have risk anymore, you could just let people expand their balance sheets and just go hog wild and use that, his view of risk for as the justification for allowing the sweeps program, which allows banks to effectively hold zero reserve requirements against demand deposits, which I thought was a bad idea at the time. At any rate, so he had some failings, this guy.
But you see, this is related.
Okay, tie it
right up. If you believe that fraud is possible, then derivatives are a potential problem. If you believe that fraud is impossible, and that these people are sophisticated, remember your sophistication illusion again?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Then it is unambiguous with neoclassical economic theory that the greater the choices, the better the results.
Hmm.
Because people will only make good choices for themselves. And as a result, by definition, the purchaser of the derivative will be the one who finds it most valuable. And since asset valuation and risk are inversely related, it will be the entity that perceives holding that derivative as least risky. In other words, you will get derivatives held by the ideal people for whom they're in idiosyncratic conditions that reduce the holding, the risk of holding that derivative for them. And so you will optimize throughout the entire financial system the placement of risk in the ideal fashion with the people best situated to have that risk. And not only do you have that advantage, but on top of that, it means you will broadly diversify the risks such that there is very little concentration of risk. And therefore, your entire financial system will systemically be far less risky. So though they knew all of those things as soon as they started with the assumption that there couldn't be any frauds.
Hmm. Well, if you're going to rest that on the efficient market hypothesis, there is one other little assumption baked into that, which is that we have even flows of information. There are no information asymmetries. And the very definition of fraud is that it has an asymmetry of information. I can't square that circle either. There's an intellectual hole in what you're describing that's just gigantic.
Well, enough to drive the world's largest financial bubble through. The greatest epidemic of elite fraud in history of the world. Yeah. This is what we call, America has just gone through this recognition that it was being scammed merchants who were secretly adulterating our hamburgers by adding pink slime. Right? And pink slime turned out to be added to a level that maxed out at about 15%. And the reason it was maxed out at about 15% is it tended to smell and taste bad.
Mm-hmm.
But in the financial way, and by the way, pink slime starts out with these ultra fatty tissues, which are much more susceptible inherently to having strong contamination by E. coli,
mm-hmm.
in particular, and some other things. So they give it an ammonia bath, right? They put Mr. Clean in gaseous form to try to reduce how infectious pink slime is. And it turns out there's a trade-off. That's why it stinks. If you put enough ammonia in to really make it close to safe, then it really smells and tastes bad. So they don't put enough ammonia in to really keep it safe. So it's also unsafe, but it's, you know, not, if you eat a burger, you're not typically going to get sick. In fact, it's quite unusual if you order it at least medium. But that's not true in finance. In finance, it wasn't, you know, a maximum of 15% of some areas were fraudulent. We had whole areas, liar's loans, where the fraud incidence, when the people measured it, was 90%, 90.
Wow.
And we had whole areas, like collateralized debt obligations, in which the most typical CDO, collateralized debt obligation, was backed overwhelmingly by fraudulent liar's loans.
And we knew about this at the time. There was open articles about ninja loans, and the, you know, this was a very open secret. At least it was to me. I was shorting, this is a matter of public record, I was shorting a bunch of mortgage insurers and home builders and whatnot all the way down through this piece, because it was so obvious to me that this was a problem. And I'm just an outsider, right? I'm just some guy. I read stuff and I understand a few things, but it was so painfully obvious to me that we had this huge, gigantic issue going on, and it was to insiders too. Like Michael Lewis in The Big Short details very carefully about how Goldman Sachs with John Paulson went out and handpicked the worst things that were designed to blow up, and then Goldman Sachs went out and got a so-called independent third party's position saying, "Hey, this portfolio was randomly selected to succeed when it was actually, I believe, selected to fail," and then misrepresented that to clients and sold these toxic bundles off because Paulson needed somebody on the other side of that trade, often maybe a German bank or somebody like that. So when I look at that, to me, that I can't find a more clear-cut definition of fraud than that, and yet I'm not aware of any prosecutions or criminal activity that resulted from that. I believe there might have been a fine, but that's all I can recall at this point. How does that skate through? Did I have the essence of that story right?
Yes, but it goes farther back. So, and there's a more basic economic problem as well. The definition, after all, the defining element about what makes something a liar's loan is that you don't do adequate underwriting. Underwriting is a process of evaluating whether you're going to get repaid when you make a loan and what are the risks of it, so that you can price, you know, decide whether you should make the loan, on what conditions, and at what price. You should do that. And because when you don't do underwriting on this kind of loan, a mortgage loan, you inherently create something that we call adverse selection. So if you thought of running a health insurance company or life insurance company, and you weren't going to do any evaluation of your customer's health or their parents', you know, their genetic relatives' health, you were just going to charge a high price for your insurance to compensate for the risk. Which customers would come to you? Well, obviously only the sickest. Same thing if you couldn't determine loan quality and you just charged everybody a high rate of interest as a result. Which customers would come to you? Only the worst. And so in this kind of loans, if you create adverse selection, you create, from the lender's perspective, a negative expected value of making a loan. In plain English, that means you will lose money. It's equivalent of betting against the house. And therefore, honest lenders don't engage in adverse selection. So it's a wonderful natural experiment as to which entities were clearly engaged in fraud. Entities making liar's loans were clearly engaged in fraud, mortgage lenders doing that. Okay, so we realized this as regulators in 1990 and 1991. Now, let me emphasize those dates again.
Mm-hmm.
1990 and 1991. And America being America, liar's loans being a fraud, began most heavily where all financial frauds tend to develop in America, and that would be Orange County, California. Right? And we were the regional regulators for California, Arizona, and Nevada. And eventually a broader, the whole one-third of the West, one-third of the United States, it's the West. So we looked at these and we said, this is insane. These liar's loans are becoming common. They must lead to fraud. In fact, they only make sense from a lender's perspective if the lender is engaged in accounting control fraud. And so we use normal supervisory means to drive them out of the savings and loan industry. The leading entity making these liar's loans also targeted minorities, particularly blacks and Latinos, who families who couldn't speak English as well. Blacks because they have fewer connections and fewer choices in the financial industry. So this is a real pernicious place. It was called Long Beach Savings. And they were one of the entities we cracked down on. So Long Beach Savings Head voluntarily gave up federal deposit insurance, voluntarily gave up his charter to run a savings and loan, and became a mortgage bank for the sole purpose of escaping our regulatory jurisdiction. And as a mortgage bank, he was subject to no federal regulation in that era, other than active discrimination against minorities, right? Mm-hmm. This is not Community Reinvestment Act. This is active, I'm out discriminating against minorities.
Right.
The truth, you know, the fair lending laws. Now, his leading competitor is another entity run by a husband-wife team that we removed and prohibited from the savings and loan industry, the GEDNACs. To ease this fraud, the head of Long Beach Savings also changes the name of the organization, the now mortgage bank, and names it AmeriQuest. So for people who know this industry, they will now be nodding.
Mm-hmm.
So AmeriQuest becomes the biggest and the baddest, and it as it's going out the door, we make this referral for discrimination. And the Justice Department follows up and finds active discrimination. So that's their second strike, right? The first strike is we went after them for the liar's loans. The second strike is the Justice Department goes after them. And, of course, they make nice, and they promise that they will approve things, and of course the Justice Department doesn't bring a criminal action, just a civil action, and gets a settlement. Then, of course, AmeriQuest does absolutely the same thing, targeting blacks, targeting Latinos, outright fraudulent loans, forges people's signatures, the whole nine yards, just a completely out of control accounting control fraud, following the recipe that I talked about. And at that juncture, 49 state AGs plus the Attorney General of District of Columbia sue them. Why not the 50th? Well, because that was Virginia, and at that time, Virginia actually had some rules. And so they avoided making mortgages in Virginia. Hmm. But everybody else sues them. they settle for hundreds of millions of dollars, the biggest settlement of such a kind. Again, no criminal action. Whereupon we make the head of AmeriQuest our ambassador to the Netherlands. Why? Well, because, of course, he was the leading campaign contributor to George Bush. Now, that's politics as usual. His name is Arnaud. But if you want, again, the antecedents of this crisis, two entities rush to acquire AmeriQuest from our now ambassador, or our now about to be ambassador. Now, again, this place is absolutely notorious. It has 1,000 employees, you know, thereabouts, who every day go in, and if they're doing substance, what they do is engage in fraud. And a particularly pernicious fraud where they look for the most vulnerable people in society to defraud. And Citicorp and Washington Mutual rush to acquire its operations. And therefore, we are shocked that Citicorp and Washington Mutual made tens of billions, in the case of Washington Mutual, hundreds of billions, actually in the case of both of them, hundreds of billions of dollars of fraudulent loans and loan sales. So, that just brought us up, you know, into the 90s and the early 2000s. So, again, we knew in spades, and we not only didn't bring criminal action, we rewarded the frauds. We left them wealthy. We allowed them to sell. They were treated as respectable by the most elite financial institutions in the world, Citicorp and Washington Mutual being among them. And we bestowed our highest honors on the leading frauds. What happens next is by 2004, the FBI warns two things. One, that there is an epidemic of mortgage fraud. Epidemic was their word. And two, warns that it will produce a financial crisis. Crisis being their word, if it is not checked. 2004. And here's a key thing. The FBI person in charge of the effort against mortgage fraud was interviewed by the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the inevitable national commission to investigate the causes of this crisis. And he reported that the federal banking regulatory agencies never got in touch with him once, either before or after he made this warning about an epidemic of fraud. Now, can you imagine that? You're the federal banking regulators, the FBI, publicly, and this gets reported all over the place, trade press, general press, says epidemic of mortgage fraud is going to cause a financial crisis. And nobody in the Financial Regulatory Center says boo and follows up on it in the least. And here's a footnote also about the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. So Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States of America under Obama, and therefore the head of the FBI as well, in other words, the Bureau is part of the Justice Department, is called to testify in front of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Now, what is the most famous thing the Justice Department /FBI did? Issue this warning in 2004. And Holder's the head of a huge department filled with incredibly bright people who prep him for a testimony like this so the agency looks good and so Holder looks good, right? That's your job, prep the guy so he looks good and doesn't get embarrassed. And what is the first question have to be out of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission? It's got to be, hey, what did you do in response to your own warning?
Yep.
So that is, in fact, the first question asked Holder. And Holder, at that point, and Holder is accompanied by his staff and by Lanny Brewer, the head of the criminal division.
Yep.
And his answer is, what warning? I've never heard of this. Which means nobody up there is passing a note saying, I'll take this, Eric.
Uh-huh.
There's no answer. None of them had ever heard of the warning. That's how big a priority elite financial frauds had in the incoming Obama administration.
You know, this makes my blood pressure rise just a little. And I can hear in your voice that you care very much about this, too. You know, justice and fair play need to return to our system. And I want to talk about this for a minute because it's very important, the potential corrosive impact this has on society. At a recent interview with Gretchen Morgenson, and I asked her about accountability because she's been obviously following this very closely as well. And she had this to say. She said, the idea that forging signatures, that notarizing very important legal documents really improperly in thousands of cases, maybe millions, the idea that this is somehow going to be allowed to go on with just sort of a penalty of some kind or a fine and not prosecuted in the criminal courts, I think is amazing. It really is counter to what we've all been led to believe was the course of action in such a case. You have many small people, small fry mortgage fraudsters who are in jail. I mean, we are talking about the people who were straw buyers for homes, who defrauded banks. They are in jail for a reason, because they perpetrated a fraud. These banks, whose employees were forging signatures, should also have been prosecuted with vigor, and they were not. They were simply allowed to negotiate their way out of trouble and negotiate their way with shareholders' money. They are not paying it out of their own executives' pockets. They are paying it out of the shareholders' pockets. There really is no accountability here whatsoever. So, in your words, why is accountability or its lack so important to each of us? Or I know some people aren't even paying attention to this particular issue. To me, it's incredibly important because I'm detecting very powerfully two sets of rules. I just did my taxes, so maybe I have a little extra ire here. Because if I don't follow the letter of the law perfectly, there's a little box on my tax document that says if I sign there and I'm signing with knowing material misrepresentations, it's a felony, right? I daily face very serious consequences of my own actions at my level, but I'm a little guy. Is that an unfair sort of summary of this, that there might be two sets of rules going on here?
Yeah, and it's what people have always warned about in crony capitalism. So there's a very conservative French economist, not long dead. The name's pronounced something in French like Bastiat, mm-hmm. but it looks like Bastiat in terms of English spelling and pronunciation. Who said, and again I'll get pretty close to exact, when plunder becomes a way of life, a legal system becomes adopted that legalizes it, and a moral code is adopted that glorifies it. And so that's what crony capitalism, when you fully descend into it, and it's clear that the United States has descended into a version of crony capitalism. So let me tie together this accountability point and these warnings. Let me do the 2006 warnings and the reaction of the industry to both the 2004 and 2006, because that portion that you're talking about, Gretchen is talking about by far the smallest frauds that the lenders engaged in, which is at the foreclosure stage.
Mm-hmm.
But well before the foreclosure stage, you have multiple levels of massive fraud that drive the entire global crisis. So in early 2006, the industry, the lending industries, own anti-fraud experts, a group called BARI, an acronym, M-A-R-I, issue a report that goes in writing to every member of the Mortgage Bankers Association, so thousands of entities, everybody involved. And it says, first, loans where you don't underwrite are, quote, an open invitation to fraudsters. Unquote. Second, when we've studied them, the incidence of fraud is 90%, 90.
Yep.
So they're virtually all frauds. Third, these loans deserve the phrase that the industry itself uses to describe them. They are liar's loans. Fourth, you apparently have forgotten the experience of the early 90s. Remember when I was telling you about 1990, 1991?
Yep.
When these loans caused hundreds of millions of dollars of losses. Hundreds is even more quaint, right?
Yep.
And fifth, the federal banking regulatory agencies. Remember, this is the Bush era. Banking regulatory agencies are warning against making these kinds of loans.
Hmm.
Okay, so you have all those warnings from the FBI. You have them from the industry's own experts. You have the fact that inherently in economics, you will lose money, that this creates adverse selection, and that no honest lender would do this. What happens? What's the industry reaction to hearing all this? Between 2003 and 2006, liar's loans expand over 500%. And this is the perfect natural experiment. You know, you may have heard these stuff, the claims that this Community Reinvestment Act or that was Fannie and Freddie, affordable housing requirements that drove the crisis. This is a favorite meme. No.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever required any lender to make or any entity to purchase a liar's loan. In fact, Fannie and Freddie were not permitted to count liar's loans towards their affordable housing goal. So the reason they did massive amounts of these loans was because of the fraud recipe. Remember, grow really rapidly by making really crappy loans, but at a premium yield. And liar's loans are perfect for that, because in the old days, the things we used to prosecute people, we had actual rules. And they were really simple rules on underwriting. In essence, you can summarize it in this brief statement. One, before you make the loan, you have to underwrite. Two, you have to document that the borrower has the ability to repay the loan. And three, you have to keep a written record of this underwriting. Now, if you have those three simple rules, which any honest lender would do if regulators never existed, right? They do all three of those things. So it imposes no cost on the honest portion of the industry. You can see there's a bind if you want to lie,
mm-hmm.
if you want to do liar's loans, right? Because if you're going to loan to people who are make really crappy loans, you're going to put in your files documentation that you knew you were making bad loans that people couldn't repay. And if you document that you knew that, your regulator is likely to say, even under the Bush administration, maybe you shouldn't make those loans, and maybe it's my job as a regulator to order you to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you try to change the paper trail so that the regulators don't see that, if you either forge documents or destroy documents, well, that is an additional level of fraud that we can prosecute. And we can introduce it to show what your underlying intent was in making these kinds of loans. So that's really good for establishing a fraud case. But with a liar's loan, you don't have to, as the lender, document any lies on your part, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't do any underwriting, so you don't create a paper trail that shows you knew it was a bad loan, because the definition of liar's loan is you don't verify. And so it's a perfect device for doing a fraud, right? So that's one thing that we had done. And by the way, that rule change occurred in the savings and loan industry in 1993, under the Clinton administration. And that was part of reinventing government. And I was personally there to witness this. The regulators were instructed that we were to refer to the industry and to think of the industry as our, and I'm quoting, client.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more devastating mindset for ruining regulation than to define the industry you're supposed to regulate as we're supposed to serve that industry instead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in response to these warnings, the industry massively increases liar's loans, with nobody requiring it, and indeed the federal government warning against it, even under the Bush administration, such that by 2006, one out of every three new home loans was a liar's loan. And remember, they're 90% fraudulent. And we also know that it was overwhelmingly lenders who put the lies in the liar's loans and did so by creating those incentive structures to make sure the mortgage bankers and the mortgage brokers would bring them loans consistent with a recipe. Incredible numbers, really crappy, and a premium yield. Okay, so back in the day, in the savings and loan crisis, as Akerlof and Romer said, the examiners in the field recognized that this was looting and fraud from the beginning. And so the re-regulation of the savings and loan industry begins in 1983. Now, that's really important because the deregulation of the industry, the big acts, are 1982 and 1983. 1982 by the federal government, the Garn-St. Germain Act, and then 1983 by California, and then followed by Texas. And so what this created is what we call a regulatory race to the bottom, or economists call sometimes a competition in laxity. Who can have the weakest rules to attract the industry to come, because the industry that's committing fraud really loves weak rules. And California and Texas won, where obviously won should be in quotation marks, this race to the bottom in the savings and loan crisis. And between just those two states, their savings and loans produced two-thirds of total losses for the entire savings and loan debacle. Think of that. Two states that deregulated the most produce two-thirds of the total losses.
This concludes part one of this deep-diving interview with Bill Black. In part two, we get into why our regulatory system has failed so badly that no real convictions against the fraud that caused the housing bubble or the credit crisis have been prosecuted, and why we, as a populace, remain disconcertingly vulnerable to the behavior and mindset that creates such Ponzi schemes. Part 2 is reserved for ChrisMartinson.com's enrolled members. To learn more about enrolling, please visit ChrisMartinson.com.